Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. The big story that official Washington and much of the world is still digesting is the stunning rebuke the Supreme Court dealt the Bush administration yesterday. The High Court called the president's plan for military tribunals at Guantanamo unconstitutional. That's among the issues our weekly panel of journalists will take on this hour. Also up for discussion, the impact of another High Court ruling on redistricting. The political right declares war on the New York Times. Congress tries to declare war on flag burning. Also, the best way to spend $1.5 billion. Up next on Point, our weekly roundtable considers the limits of presidential power, the politics of the flag and philanthropy. And are boys really doing so badly in school, or is it all those so-called education experts that need help with their homework? We've got great analysts with us this hour to size up the big stories of the week. Joining me in the studio is Tony Norman, columnist for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. And Tony, welcome. It's great to have you here.
It's good to be here.
And with us from Washington, D.C. is Kathleen Parker, syndicated columnist for Tribune Newspapers. Kathleen, welcome to you.
Thanks so much. Good to hear from you.
It's fun to have you here. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, our own Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. And happy 4th of July weekend to you, Jack.
Thank you. And to you, Anthony. And hello, Tony and Kathleen.
Hey. How you doing, Jack?
So what I want to do is just sort of go around our virtual roundtable here and just get a quick hit from all of you about sort of your top story to kind of put in motion this discussion. Tony Norman here in the studio, let me start with you. What caught your eye this week? What should we be discussing?
Well, I think the jihad against the New York Times should be front and center for all journalists because this touches us all where we hurt, literally. Our job is to shine a light, and I think that there's a little bit of obscuring and darkness that needs to be dispersed.
Okay, this is the story about the very angry reaction from many conservatives about the New York Times decision last week to run a story about a secret government program to track international terrorist financing. Conservatives very upset about that. We'll take that on. Kathleen Parker, to you, what's caught your attention this week?
Well, I would definitely jump on with Tony on that one. But, you know, also, I think one of the biggest stories is what's going on with Israel and the Palestinians. As you know, the Palestinians have very much upped their aggression toward Israel, and they've kidnapped this Israeli soldier. They've already killed this 18-year-old kid and threatened to kill the Israeli soldier if their demands aren't met, whatever those are. I don't think we're very clear on that. And meanwhile, Israel is giving them a chance diplomatically. But yesterday they seized, 64 members of Hamas in the West Bank and a third of the Palestinian cabinet and 23 legislators. So, you know, it seems like Israel is letting them know they're quite serious. But it feels like things could get out of hand very quickly. So
worrying indeed.
That's a big story.
It looks like the fate of one Israeli corporal could really determine whether the region is again plunged into a new cycle of war and violence. We'll keep an eye on that. Jack Beatty in Hanover, New Hampshire. What else should we be talking about today?
Well, the Guantanamo ruling. You know, when Benjamin Franklin came out of Constitution Hall in Philadelphia after they had framed the Constitution, someone asked, "What had you done there?" And he said, "We've created a republic if we can keep it. The republic is safe. George Bush is not a king." That's what the Supreme Court said. He is not our king. He is subject to the rule of law, international law, our own law. And the rationale that Justice Stevens used in his decision, which is that the September 2001 congressional resolution did not give the president authority to depart from the law in the handling of these detainees, that rationale also applies, as Senator Spector has pointed out, or may well apply, to the NSA's wiretapping. So this decision doesn't just stop with the Guantanamo, although that's serious enough. It gives us a chance to end this self-inflicted wound, which is Guantanamo. Richard Clark, the terrorist advisor to Bush, used to say he sometimes felt Mr. Bush was channeling Osama bin Laden. Nowhere has he channeled him better than in Guantanamo, which has turned into an international disaster for this country that far outstrips any gain we could possibly have got from these detainees.
All right, Jack. Well, let's start.
Amen to that.
Let's start with this subject, and let's start with a clip of tape. President Bush speaking yesterday about the court's 5-3 decision on Guantanamo Bay at a joint news conference with Japanese Prime Minister Koizumi. Let's listen to the president now.
We will conform to the Supreme Court. We will analyze the decision. To the extent that the Congress is given any latitude to develop a way forward using military tribunals, we will work with them. As I understand, a senator has already been on TV. Haven't seen it, hadn't heard what he said, but as they briefed me and said, he wants to devise law in conformity with the case that would enable us to use a military tribunal to hold these people to account. And if that's the case, we'll work with him.
Yeah, there's the president speaking yesterday about the Supreme Court's decision. Kathleen Parker, let me start with you just because you're in Washington. He talked about Congress sort of responding to this situation. What's your sense about where Congress goes with this now?
Well, I think it's, you know, several Republican leaders in the Congress have made statements and have said, well, you know, it's clear that now we have to come up with some way to allow these tribunals through the Congress, and they intend to to pursue some congressional remedy to this ruling. I don't think they're giving up. I don't think they think they've done wrong. I think the Supreme Court ruling simply says that this is not the way to go about it, and so they're going to find another way to go about it.
I guess I'm reading that Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist says he'll introduce legislation after July 4th to authorize military tribunals that would include some kind of appropriate due process procedure. Tony Norman, does that sound to you like a solution to this, a beginning of the way out of the Guantanamo? I mean, it's a difficult situation that the country has put itself in.
It's an extremely difficult situation, and I wish I could share your optimism. I think that this is a literally we backed into this situation in Guantanamo, and we didn't have a plan. We thought that the bad guys would be a little more obvious to us, and they're not. I mean, lots of people were picked up on battlefields, and maybe they were shepherds, and maybe they were combatants. We don't know what they are or who they are, and we haven't figured out a way to deal with them or to give them justice. And I quite frankly am not convinced that the administration has the will yet. Certainly the Supreme Court says they better develop the political will to do justice here, but I don't think that it's really been internalized yet. Mm. So I don't think anything will...
Well, I think they're very concerned about conferring rights and privileges on terrorists. And as you say, some of these people may not be terrorists. I don't think anyone expected things to drag on quite this long without knowing who these people are specifically. But I'm willing to bet that if this ruling had come down at a time closer to 9/11, there'd be less.
Right.
The response would certainly be a little bit different.
Right.
But it's no doubt it's a terrible public relations statement for the president and for our status in the world.
Jack Beatty, you spoke eloquently a moment ago about the sweeping nature of this. I mean, the ruling was narrowly focused, but as you suggest, it has a sort of sweeping ramifications. But does it sort of suggest to Congress and the president sort of how to proceed? I mean, how do they proceed? This is a sticky problem. The future of these 450 detainees, not clear at all.
Not clear at all. And as to the wider ramifications, you know, the decision cited here was the Youngstown Steel decision of 1952, Justice Jackson's opinion. And under that opinion, Justice Jackson laid out a three-part test for presidential power. In the first case, where there was a law and the president acted in accordance with that, his power was absolute. In the second case, which is like this one, where there is no law and the president acts, that's a shady area. But the third area is when there is a statute and the president acts against it. That's what he did with the NSA. And there, Justice Jackson said, that is when presidential power is weakest. And I think that there was a shot across the bow here to the Bush administration about the NSA business. Mm. That's going to reach the court. And it seems to me that if they're invoking Justice Jackson against this gray area of, you know, no statute, what will they do when there's a statute?
Very interesting. Jack, very quickly, we have like 30 seconds left before the break, but I sort of wanted to switch directions a little bit and sort of play off this Guantanamo decision in this way, and that is the Supreme Court obviously says to the president, Congress makes the laws, but this week Congress was trying to make a very different set of law about flag burning.
Yes, they were. There have been 200 cases of flag burning in 215 years, not an urgent problem. One of the groups that advocates this says that there was a 33% increase in flag burning last year. That is, it went from 3 to 4.
That's an amazing stat.
And you know, this is a fake solution to a fake problem. I mean, and to think it's that this was something tied up the Senate is just unbelievable. But kudos to Mitch McConnell, the minority whip, I mean the majority whip, who is a principal libertarian who voted against this, to Senator Bennett, also a Republican from Utah, who voted against it, to Lincoln Chafee, also from a Republican who also voted against it. You know, there are some profiles and courage here, something in this really low business to be proud of.
My guests are Tony Norman, a columnist for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, who joins me here in the studio in Boston, Kathleen Parker, syndicated columnist for Tribune Newspapers from Washington, D.C., and Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst and senior editor for The Atlantic Monthly. Tony Norman kicked off the first break talking about the big story about the very angry reaction from many conservatives about the New York Times decision last week to run a story about a secret government program to track international terrorist financing. The backlash was considerable. Here's Representative Peter King, Republican of New York, who emerged as one of the harshest critics of the New York Times, pushing for a criminal investigation of the paper. He was talking with Fox News Sunday's Chris Wallace.
No one elected the New York Times to do anything. And the New York Times is putting its own arrogant, elitist, left-wing agenda before the interests of the American people. And I'm calling on the Attorney General to begin a criminal investigation and prosecution of the New York Times, its reporters, the editors that worked on this, and the publisher. We're in time of war, Chris, and what they've done here is absolutely disgraceful. I believe they've violated the Espionage Act, the Comey Act. This is absolutely disgraceful. The time has come. The American people are...
Kathleen Parker, help. That was Representative Peter King. Kathleen Parker, respond to that. I mean, prosecution. Nobody elected these journalists. I'm a little scared. Nobody elected me either.
Yeah, no, I think this is a really serious situation, and yeah. It's you know, the Republicans are clearly taking advantage of a moment here, because there's nothing that the right wing enjoys more than hating the New York Times. And King used the keywords arrogant, elitist, and left wing. This is called animating your base. but the truth of the matter is, you know, we've become so polarized. This really shows how ridiculous it's become. Because on the one hand, there seem to be only two schools of thought, right? You're either Bush is evil and everything he does is evil, and therefore we have to expose him, or you know, the media are left wing, always trying to undermine the administration, and, right. And they want Saddam Hussein back in power, and you know, they're members of Al Qaeda, so somewhere in between. I think we have to recognize that, yes, indeed, this is a different world. This president has expanded executive powers more than anyone ever before. And the media have a very serious job here in making sure that we do our job. I mean, I'm here as what is considered a conservative columnist, but I am also, you know, not prepared to say that the media are always wrong and that you can't ever report on anything that the government says you shouldn't. I mean, Stalinist Russia felt that way too. Yeah. I mean, all totalitarian governments begin by suppressing the free speech and the press.
And kudos to you.
So this is serious, and it's not to be, throwing these words around like we've got to, you know, prosecute them for treason. Mm-hmm. Right. And I mean, some people have just gone completely wacko on this. So
You did a great column, a very nuanced column on this very issue. So I have to take my hat off to you about that. But I think
nuanced in print.
There was a report recently about how Jon Stewart in The Daily Show makes you cynical about politics. I'll tell you what makes people cynical about politics is when a Representative Peter King stands up and says this stuff that, you know, it's more appropriate for Imus in the Morning. It's not serious. He's just trying. He's basically carrying the administration's water. You know, let's demonize the press at a time of low poll, at a time of uncertainty. And, he really ought to be called on it. But more important than that, I think there really needs to be a discussion, a wide-ranging discussion about the place of the press, because I think there really is a confusion. Certainly our politicians don't understand what our role is, but maybe the people don't. There's no evidence, though, that anyone is falling for this claptrap. Still, it wouldn't be a bad idea to have a discussion about what the media's role is and what is a secret and, you know, under what conditions is it right to reveal these things. I think it would clarify a lot of issues, maybe even for our president.
That would be a good result of this.
Jack Beatty, let me draw you into this discussion. I mean, is there room in this sort of loud, angry dispute for what Tony Norman calls a nuanced discussion here about the responsible role of the press in times of war? I mean, maybe in the midst of this, there is some middle ground that we can arrive at.
Well, but not on this case. I mean, this is, as people have pointed out, I'm quoting here a former U.S. official who was involved in this business. He said it was common knowledge that worldwide financial transactions were being monitored. He goes on to say that the terrorists would have known this unless they are dumb.
Right.
Well, I guess that's the question. Who's dumb?
Right.
I mean, you know.
Yeah, that was my very first reaction. Who didn't know this?
Yeah. Right.
Exactly. Exactly. And you know, Peter King is treating us as if we're dumb, as if
right.
we can't read this in the paper,
right.
as if we don't know that the United States has been boasting, and I guess rightly, since they've had some success, since practically right after September 11th, that we have been doing this. President Bush has boasted about it. It's one of the things that we have done successfully. And you know, pretend that, oh, my God, there's gambling going on here.
I'm shocked. Shocked. Absolutely. 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Tony, you were about to say something.
Yeah, I had a question, and maybe Jack can enlighten me on this. We heard a clip of the vice president a few minutes ago saying the New York Times has made it impossible for us to do our work in the future when it comes to this sort of spying. What did he mean by that? I mean, how does this the public's knowledge of this program even impair our ability to? I mean, there's still going to be financial transactions going on, and presumably terrorists still need money. I mean, how exactly does this impair our ability to see what they're doing?
It's not at all clear to me. I don't know, Jack, if you want to take a stab at that.
No, I don't have any sense of how it would at all. I think he was also alluding, of course, to last year's New York Times scoop, for which they won a Pulitzer Prize, on the NSA. And that one really got Cheney's attention. In fact, he called that Pulitzer a disgrace.
Wow.
But, you know, in order to be citizens in a democracy, we have to know what the government is doing, subject to military exigency. We don't need to know what their plan is to go after somebody in Iraq. We do need to know things that impinge on our liberty so that we can begin to balance these judgments ourselves, our security versus our liberty. But if our Congress isn't doing it, who will do it? Well, this week the court did it.
Let's take a call. Sam is calling from Lincoln, Massachusetts. Hi, Sam.
Yeah, hi.
Thanks for the call. You're on the air. What's on your mind?
I would say that the biggest thing for me in the news was clearly the Supreme Court decision, where a Supreme Court hopefully indicate to a president that he's not the king, that he's not the beginning and the end of all authority. And I'm just wondering if the guests think that this might be or signal or embolden the Congress to take another look at NSA vis-a-vis the FISA law, where, if my memory serves me well, another president thought that he could break the law. And Congress said, no, you can't. We put people like that in jail. And it's just reminiscent of a long list of presidents like Nixon, like Reagan, who believe that they can break the law. And I'm just wondering, do the guests think that this might be a signal that Congress might say, you know, maybe the president isn't above the law. Maybe we should take another look at FISA and say, gee, this president clearly told us he's above the law.
Yep.
I don't care.
We got it, Sam. It's a good one. Yeah, go ahead, Kathleen Parker.
Well, I would say that I'm sure that they will look at it again, especially if the polls suggest they should. But I think it's not quite fair to say that this ruling says that the president broke the law. I think these are different ways of interpreting law, and that's what the Supreme Court does. But, you know, there's clearly a divide on the court as to whether this was inappropriate. If you count Justice Roberts' vote on his previous ruling in the appellate court, then you've got a 5-4 split, and that's not exactly an overwhelming majority in terms of whether this was wrong. I mean, they rule, but I think there's still some debate about it. I don't think he could quite go as far as saying he broke the law. He got an interpretation of law that made him feel that what he was doing was legal. And in fact, this particular case is legal. I mean, not Guantanamo, but the, help me out here, guys. I'm drawing a blank
NSA?
Here.
The NSA?
Not the NSA.
The FISA. No,
yes,
no.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
No.
Sorry, we're drawing a blank too.
Yeah, well, it's what we're talking about, but I just kind of lost my train of thought.
Guantanamo. Well, you know, the New Yorker this week tells how this idea came about for these tribunals. It was done behind the back of Secretary of State Colin Powell without the consent, without the knowledge of Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, by David Addington, who's the chief of now the chief of staff of Vice President Cheney and then his number one legal guy. And he was the guy that came up with this protocol without any process to talk about what it was. And the president said, well, it sounds good to me. Let's do it. This is another case, you know, where Dick Cheney and his view of the imperial presidency have really hurt President Bush certainly cost him in world opinion. But even here, Americans don't like, they're willing to give a president latitude, especially in a time of war. But they don't like dictators. They don't like kings.
Right. And our fear is starting to dissipate. And we're starting to see very clearly what's going on here. And I think these news stories, every one of them in a way, eats at the fear that formerly kept us hampered in. Mm. And
the thing I was trying to think of was the banking thing. I mean, you know, 80% of you can say, yes, Americans don't want a monarch, and that is true. But 80% of Americans also, or some 80%, approve of this tracking the secret banking mining that the president was doing and that the New York Times exposed. So again,
I don't know if the New York Times, I'm sorry, but when you say, the New York Times certainly publicized this, but I don't think the intent of the Times was to somehow indict the president, you know, for another bad thing like NSA or
Well, but every time you use the word secret, you know, you're suggesting up to no good illegal.
But Kathleen, in a sense, didn't the administration sort of put itself in this situation, and that there have been credible questions about the warrantless surveillance, for example, and even given the context of this week's Supreme Court decision, there is this notion that, hey, you know, presidential power does need to be checked in this time, and this all seems to be a piece.
No, I blame both the Bush administration and the New York Times for what has befallen them, because Bush has had a very secretive administration and is always trying to see what he can basically get away with, what will pass legal muster without, you know, legal but not necessarily right. Mm-hmm. And the New York Times has invited this kind of assault because they have been, you know, consistently anti-Bush, anti-war. And, you know, if you look at the way they've played stories in the paper throughout the war, it's always been to highlight what is wrong with us. And, you know, you can just go back
they haven't always been. I mean, some would say the New York Times was even credulous about the war.
In the lead up to the war, certainly, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, don't get me wrong. I can't wait to get my New York Times every day.
Go ahead, Jack. And then I want to get to a caller. Go ahead.
I was just going to say the New York Times sat on the NSA story for a year.
Yeah, which was a big mistake.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, talk about responsible.
Yeah. So now they're overcompensating, one would say, or one could argue.
Let's go to Frank, who's calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Frank.
I just wanted to mention, it's probably not the most important thing to talk about. I'm not sure about that. But the Israeli aggression toward the Palestinians, I think, is something that does not get enough coverage in the news. The Israelis left Gaza, but as soon as they did, they closed down the borders to control the airspace. The economy of the company cut off tax receipts to the Palestinians. The economy deepens. People get frustrated, lob a few rockets into southern Israel, and then Israel starts retaliating. Then the retaliation escalates. A number of Palestinian Hamas leaders, they're starting to target assassinations again, and innocent bystanders are also killed. 50 Palestinians have been killed in this recent escalating violence.
Yeah, it's a troubling moment over there, Frank, and I appreciate the call. Kathleen Parker talked to Frank about this. I know this is the story that was one of the stories on top of your list this morning.
Well, one of them, I tell you, I'm very depressed about this whole thing, and I'm by no means an expert. If I were, I'd be living on an island somewhere, and this would all be, everybody be a happy democracy in the Middle East. But, you know, the Israelis left Gaza almost a year ago, and the Palestinians, in fact, have been firing on Israel just about every single day. And what's happened, I think, is my understanding is, you know, for one thing, Bush said, well, we're going into Iraq to try to draw the terrorists there, so we can fight them there rather than here. But at the same time, when Israel moved out of Gaza, you know, that became a vacuum, and the terrorists have also filled that area. So that's become a hotbed of jihadi activity as well. So it's more complicated than whether the Israelis are being aggressive toward the Palestinians. The Palestinian government is a terrorist organization. And they are more, you know, their aggressiveness toward Israel can be viewed as a celebration of their sense that Israel, that they have a victory over Israel for Israel's pulling out. So now Israel is back, and I don't see any way to resolve this except with a very great show of force. And if they kill this, the Palestinians kill this 19-year-old soldier, I think we have, you know, an apocalyptic moment upon us.
Stefan is calling from Boston. Hi, Stefan.
Hello.
What's on your mind? You're on the air.
Well, I'm calling about the flag burning issue, actually.
Very good.
And I have a question about how a constitutional amendment and any subsequent legislation would actually be formed or written. I think to myself, well, what happens if you reverse which stripes of the flag are red and which ones are white? Is that burning a flag if you burn it? What about if you project an American flag against a white sheet and then you burn the sheet that you're projecting the slide? Are you burning the flag? I mean, it just seems like a completely specious kind of an unenforceable thing, and I'm curious about how, if somebody were to seriously do this, they would even go about doing it. I mean, are you burning a flag if you burn a photograph of somebody burning a flag?
They're all good
well,
questions.
Unfortunately, it didn't pass.
Anyone want to take that one on?
Well, you know, during the debate about this, Frank Lautenberg, the New Jersey Democrat, unveiled a big photograph, and it was of Kid Rock at the Republican National Convention draped in a flag.
There you go.
And, yeah, exactly. I mean, of course, the word they use there is desecrate, which clearly would apply to things like this. And, you know, no one likes flag burning. But let's face it, this is a statement. Someone who's burning the flag is making a political statement. I dissent so fiercely from this American government, or maybe even from America, that this is what I do with the flag. It is the strongest possible statement of dissent.
My guests today are Tony Norman, columnist for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, Kathleen Parker, syndicated columnist for Tribune Newspapers, and Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. And before the break, our caller, Stefan, called in with a great question about the flag-burning story, and this was the story regarding the Senate narrowly defeating a proposal to ban desecration of the American flag. The proposed constitutional amendment fell one vote short, 66 to 34 of the two-thirds majority needed for it to pass. And let's hear Democratic Senator Richard Durbin of Illinois talking about this. This was from the debate on the Senate floor.
The real issue here isn't the protection of the flag, it's the protection of the Republican majority. We're not setting out to protect old glory, we're setting out to protect old politicians.
Democratic Senator Richard Durbin of Illinois talking about the proposed constitutional amendment to ban desecration of the flag. Kathleen Parker, I believe before the break you were just about to make a point about this story. I wanted to give you a chance to come back at it.
Well, I have to say, I have a hard time getting behind the notion that you can't burn a flag. I don't care if anybody burns a flag. I don't think it's a huge problem. And it is an expression of free speech and political protest. And, you know, that's just one of the byproducts of a nation of personal liberties. We are simply going to have to put up with some things we don't like.
But Kathleen,
and I happen to agree.
I'm interested.
I mean, flag burning is one of those base animators again. I mean, Bush is up in the polls, 40%.
Yep.
Now we've got the midterm elections coming up, and between Zarqawi flag burning and hating the New York Times, yeah, they're feeling pretty happy about.
You can tell Karl Rove is back at work now.
Because, yeah, he's back.
It's right. It's incredible.
I mean, I guess the Republicans see this as part of their so-called American values agenda that includes criticism of gay marriage, a prohibition on human cloning. Is this going to work? Is this the kind of stuff? Yeah, go ahead, Kathleen.
The only thing missing was the video diagnosis of Terry Schiavo.
But you know, they also see it as a way to send a signal to the court. Orrin Hatch made that point again and again. He said, "We want to send a signal that this court has got to respect majority opinion." And when the court, of course, majority overwhelmingly is it wants, you know, is against flag burning and could be persuaded or maybe is persuaded they want a constitutional amendment banning it. But he was telling the court, pay attention to the electorate. You know, you just can't think about these rights all the time. Well, of course, the court's job is to think about rights. Individual rights, not about, you know, what the majority thinks at any given moment.
But what amazes
Well, the majority doesn't understand the rights. That's what's unfortunate. And yeah. I think when we're talking about what's going on with the New York Times, we really have to do a better job of teaching the American people about what these rights are and why they're important. I think too many have glommed onto this idea, well, it's wartime, therefore anything goes. And while, you know, within some boundaries, we have to alter some rules for some period of time, I think it's very important that we make very clear why we have these protections and why free expression is so critical to our republic.
I tell you what, I'm not a big fan of No Child Left Behind, but if you know, civics were a big component of No Child Left Behind, I would be all for it. I would be for teaching our students and maybe even having mandatory civics lessons for people after the 12th grade. For me, this
How
is
about
just
a little
true-false
quiz to vote?
Poll taxes, but the right kind, the kind the left can get behind.
Okay, panelists, I want to switch directions and talk about another Supreme Court decision this week. This was on redistricting. On Wednesday, the Supreme Court upheld most of the pro-Republican Texas congressional map. The GOP-controlled Texas state legislature redrew the map in 2003 to put more Republicans in office. Democrats and minority groups sued the states, accusing Republicans of unconstitutional power grab. Here, Majority Leader Tom DeLay reacts to the high court ruling.
We used the state legislative system, and what came out of that was a fair map that represented the political will of the people of Texas.
Jack Beatty, what do you think? What's the significance of this redistricting decision?
Well, first of all, I think it shows proper deference to the political branches. I mean, the court can't set itself up as the judge of, you know, of all legislation. I mean, we do have federalism and we do have the political branches. And Senator Hatch is right. I mean, there are political decisions should be left up to the political branches. On the other side, you know, some people think that this could set up a kind of retaliation that, you know, the Democrats in states where they have majorities of both houses of the state legislature plus a governor, that they're going to go at this and do to Republicans what was done unto them. And but the risk for them, for anybody who does this, is that it looks so odious. The public thinks that's just politics and that's just crass. And, you know, it makes me we've talked about it on the show. It makes me so appreciative of the Iowa model. Good government. They have this done by an independent commission. They do the redistricting. As a result, Iowa has, I think, the most competitive congressional races in the country. And that's, I think, what the public needs to demand out of this.
How do they do that, Jack? I'm interested in that. How does Iowa do that?
Well, because it's always been a state of strong for good government, and I guess they were just tired of the back and forth about, you know, now we're every 10 years the flip around of these gerrymanders, and they agreed on this commission, and it's as I say, it's given them what very few states have, really competitive races.
Tony Norman on redistricting.
On the downside, for at least Tom DeLay, though he had a victory here in a way, the fact is the Supreme Court did find that there was egregious violation, well, actually egregious is my word, but I believe it was an egregious violation of the Voting Rights Act in redrawing Representative Henry Bonilla's 23rd District, the thing that started this whole thing off. I mean, there was disenfranchisement. And it has to be remedied, and that is not going to lead the map is not going to look the way it looks today when this is remedied.
Let's go to Johnny, who's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Johnny.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for coming on the air. What's on your mind?
Yes, I'd like to. I guess I have a wide-ranging comment. I am, as a person who came of age in the 60s, and was a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, I was a target of COINTELPRO. Hmm. And so I have a different take on the Supreme Court's decision regarding Hamdan. I take the media to task for not having been more forthcoming and more thorough in its investigation of these powers that the Bush administration has taken unto itself. I really think the media have been extremely deficient in covering all of this big power grab by the Bush administration, and have, for example, Fox News should no longer be designated Fox News. It should be designated the Republican News Network.
Yeah. Okay, Johnny, you put a great point on the table. Who wants to respond to Johnny? What do you think, Kathleen? Has the media fallen short? I mean, could the media have been more aggressive and perhaps helped resolve this whole impasse over Guantanamo earlier?
Well, first of all, as you know, it's really hard to talk about what the media ought to do.
Yeah. They're not exactly one monolithic entity.
Yeah, it's a very diverse group, and the blogosphere has certainly complicated that, and there's a lot of information out there that's not very good. And I guess when he's talking about the media, he's probably talking about what we now refer to as the mainstream, the big papers, the New York Times, Washington Post, the networks. And, you know, we can always do a better job at what we're doing, and I think we are all aware that things shifted on 9/11, and I think we're just at this point, as we're feeling a little bit more relaxed, as we discussed earlier, are we able to see a little better what we might have done differently? But there was a certain degree of cooperation in the early days. I think we were all, frankly, in a state of shock and wanted to make sure that something like 9/11 never happened again. We're willing to make all sorts of adjustments to our usual operations in order to do that. I think that is now shifting clearly, but I don't think the gentleman has a bad point at all. And some media are better than others, clearly.
Jack Beatty, any broad lessons for the media in general to sort of take away from this period?
Well, I think that everybody has said this, they were much too deferential at the beginning. Both the New York Times and the Washington Post had to run lengthy mea culpas for their uncritical or inadequate vetting of the administration's claims about weapons of mass destruction. So that was a clear failure on the part of the press to do its job as an adversary. But, you know, to Johnny's point, it seems to me what we've just seen is the press working at its best. The New York Times had this NSA story. I wish they hadn't sat on it for a year, but they had the story. Mm-hmm. They ran it. And what did Congress do?
Right.
Everyone said, here's a constitutional crisis, and no, Senator, it doesn't appear to be a constitutional crisis. Instead, the Congress seems to want to move the goal line up to where the president was and sort of retroactively say, oh, okay, what you did was legal because we're changing. You know, so in other words, unless one of the branches of government runs with it, I don't know how much the press by itself can do.
Let's go to Sam, who's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Sam.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. What's on your mind?
Well, you guys talk about the important, interesting topics, but one of the topics that is important around the world, certainly for the last few weeks, as you know, is the World Cup.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm surprised that American people don't, and importantly, the media, don't put really that much interest. There's a lot of interest out there among people who are interested in soccer. But the media here has not picked up on the story, and I really wonder the TV stations, the radio stations, the papers, the newscasters, very few stories, maybe a little, one or two columns once in a while about soccer or something.
Well, Sam, let's put this in play. Yeah, let's put this in play. But before we do, I'm just really curious, Sam, where you're from, who you're rooting for, who do you like in this World Cup?
Well, originally I'm from Mexico, and obviously I was rooting for the United States because I've been living here for many years.
Yeah.
But Mexico second, and now both are knocked off, and I guess I'm rooting for Argentina.
Yeah. Okay, great, yeah. Sam. Well, thanks for the call. Let's discuss this. I mean, it's funny because, you know, I have a 9-year-old daughter. We know from statistics that soccer is the most played sport among all American kids across the country. It beats baseball, football, it beats them all, and yet World Cup comes around, and we just don't catch fire over this
event. I think there was more interest in it this year. And as the father of three teenage boys who all play soccer fanatically, and, you know, two are on a championship soccer team back in Pittsburgh.
But you're not bragging. Right.
Not bragging. Not that I'm bragging or anything. I can tell you that in our house, the TiVo was just firing all the time, and the kids and my wife were in front of the TV. So I think that there's more interest than might be indicated in newspaper coverage and maybe news coverage. I can't think of most of the people I know are intensely curious about what's going to happen, and we're really pulling for the United States until we got knocked off. And I think there's still interest in the games. I mean, soccer is a phenomenon. Though I did read an interesting piece, and I think it was Slate last week, about go on, admit it. It was a very contrarian piece. Go on, admit it. Watching soccer is boring. I don't think it's boring at all. I'm not really clear on all the rules after all these years, but it's a fascinating game.
Jack Beattie, go ahead.
I wonder, in Argentina, how many people know who wins the World Series, or even if it's being played?
What looks like
parochialism to other people, we can turn around and say, what about your parochial? What about our national pastime? And as it happens, I'm looking at an emblem of that national pastime. The horizontal posture flying through the air of Coco Crisp.
There you go.
Making one of the great catches in baseball last night. Now, soccer may have its moments, but it's got nothing like this Coco Crisp, completely off the ground, completely extended, catching.
Oh, Jack, I can hear about 1 billion people around the world shrieking in response to that one. But listen, very quickly, we have only a couple of minutes left. This conversation about soccer sort of brings up the final phase of this hour. I'd love to just whip around the table and get from each of you briefly the story that went under the radar this week. For you, Tony Norman, what's the story?
That went under the radar?
Yeah, that caught your attention and didn't get the kind of discussion it might have merited.
Well, this went under the radar. I mean, it's so under the radar, I don't even know how accurate it is. But it's the 30th anniversary of Saturday Night Fever, that movie that kicked off the disco revolution. And it turns out we all assumed that the story was based upon a New York magazine piece that was essentially true, but the author has come out and said, you know what? I just made everything up. And so the disco revolution, the Bee Gees, all these things, they're all part of a lie.
I want to ask my producer if we can cue the disco music. Kathleen Parker, what about for you this week?
Well, a story that caught my eye that I haven't heard much about is one that ran in the Washington Post saying, hey, the boys really aren't in crisis after all. It's just that the girls are doing better. Mm. And this is a subject near and dear to my heart because I raised three sons. And there are a zillion studies out there that have shown that boys are really falling behind girls. And I always get a little suspicious when somebody comes out with a new study that seems to refute all other studies. Sort of like one day eggs are good for you, the next day eggs are bad. So I'm suspecting there may be what's the agenda behind deciding that boys are actually doing just fine? Send the money over this way.
Very interesting. Jack Beattie, in the 20 seconds that remain, what about your under-the-radar story?
Well, the story about the, quote, breathtaking waste and fraud in the hurricane aid. I mean, up to $2 billion in taxpayers' money went astray to felonious people who were applying for multiple grants, to prisoners who were getting grants from $2,000 grants from gifts from FEMA, and then FEMA's own just catastrophic mismanagement of this. I'm looking at a photograph of 10,000 empty mobile homes that are sitting down there in Hope, Arkansas, and which went for $200,000 apiece, and there's nothing to do with them. They're just going
to
sit there.
Well, they need to drag a dollar through there and see what happens.
Heck of a job.
Listen, I want to thank you all for coming in today. Thank you so much. Jack Beattie, thanks, as always, for being up there in Hanover, New Hampshire, and helping us guide us through these hours. Thanks, Jack. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
And Tony Norman, thanks for coming into the studio.
It's great meeting these people, even virtually.
Yeah, isn't it nice? And Kathleen Parker, who joined us from Washington, syndicated columnist for Tribune Newspapers, thank you so much.
Thanks, enjoyed it.
You can continue the conversation, download the On Point podcast, and subscribe to our daily newsletter at onpointradio.org. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.